How? Okay, I'm gonna say continue because it asked me about that. But when we kind of return to the original teachings, remember what a kind of technology of mind we're working with. So I'm just gonna take a little time to talk about how to take a teaching and kind of weave it into your writing and take your writing and strengthen up a confusing and elaborate teaching. I'm gonna screen share and put on a summary of the sutra. And that is it. And on the top, I'm unable to. Oh, here's, hold on, I want to make it a little bigger for you. Okay. On the top is where my source for where I got this information. And I just outlined the sutra. Just so you could remember, this is the teaching of how to acquire mindfulness. And it's broken down into, mindfulness of the body, the feelings of the mind itself, and of mind objects, or actually what that really means is phenomena, mental phenomena. All of it is phenomena. None of it is a noun, really, even though we're going to use nouns to talk about it. So this is original Buddhism. Original Buddhism is incredibly detailed and esoteric and always starts physical and always starts sensual and always starts emotional too. We forget that, but so you start with the feelings, I mean the body, then the feelings, then mind consciousness, which is really looking at those cittas that I mentioned, and mind objects, which are the mental factors of experience. So this is basically looking at the phenomenal or conditioned world. But just to remember, if you are a monk back in the day or a nun, you would be working step by step. And there's a lot of steps. So contemplation of the body is breathing, and then there are different types of breathing, different postures that you contemplate the body in, different activities. Then you look at all the body impurities and the parts of the body that typically gross us out. But honestly, whenever I do the impurities meditation, I'm always just marveled at how the body works. But and then the decomposition. In some Asian countries, monks still do sit in front of skeletons, but there are all these gruesome stages of body decomposition that used to be objects of meditation. And then feelings as an object of meditation. And the person in training would go through all of these steps and all these levels that we're going to get to of each step. So feelings, positive, negative, and neutral, and bodily or spiritual. In original Buddhism, feelings are a kind of a binary approach avoid thing that build into the complex sets of feelings that we call emotions. Then contemplation of citta mind objects in terms of hindrances, aggregates, bases, enlightenment factors, and noble truths. Looking at everything in terms of the three characteristics of anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and lack of a self, a substantial self. So it's just so many matrices of cross looking at things. The five aggregates are the skandhas, which I imagine most of you have come up with, material form, feelings, perceptions, habit formations, and consciousness, which we're going to talk about this a little later. But these are the construction materials that we use for experience, for understanding ourselves as a thing that is moving in a world of things. We use those five categories, those five bundles of experience to have some sense of understanding what's going on. So these are all of the categories of objects, and going, another typical thing here of early Buddhism is that the lists tend to ascend. When you look at a Buddhist list, like the 121 types of citta. They typically start with the kind of more negative karma stuff, and they kind of ascend into a more elevated mind state. So here we start with the hindrances, the aggregates, the bases, then we get into the enlightenment factors and the noble truths. So this list kind of brings us forward. Now, all of this, every one of these objects you look at internally and externally and both, you look at it arising and dissolving into time and both or both. You establish your awareness of the object. This gets back to what Susan was talking about. You establish your awareness of the object just enough for bare knowledge and mindfulness. So you kind of adjust your little volume control so you can hear, but you're not blasting your mindfulness. And the most important, awareness established while abiding independent, not clinging to anything in the world with neither desire nor distress. So that last one is the dropping the reactivity, dropping the past associations, dropping all the things we do with it. When I was talking about the pivot in perception, that's that last point. That's mindfulness as a solvent, dropping things that we don't need to add to reality in that moment. If you are interested in that, in anything that I screen share, you can email me later and I'll send it to you if you didn't have enough time to look at anything. And I know that one was pretty elaborate. But that's, you know, that is the actually short version of, you know, how to develop mindfulness back in the day. What I want to do with this is kind of talk about, you know, moving this with some writing. You know, whenever I get teachings, I apply writing to them. And the first thing that you can do is, Helen is asking for my email. I will, on the break, put it in the chat in case you don't have it. Yeah, good point. And I'm going to write down to do that because I am also of that age. Okay. Even if you do nothing more with writing than sutra copying, which is just take out parts of something you read and put it on a piece of paper, you are engaging the teaching with your writing, and that will really help you. But you can also, do a lot more. And one way I look at this is to make prompts out of a Buddhist teaching. Now, prompts, that's journal writing talk. And I imagine most of you have, you know, come up upon that, where you think of a question or a statement or a way to frame things up that starts your writing rolling. That's just a prompt. And everywhere you turn, there are like a million journaling prompts. And a lot of them, I think, are too vague, personally. They're like, what is in the now or something, you know, and it's good. Different ones work for different things. But this list in the Satipatthana Sutra contains thousands and thousands of writing prompts. And to look for writing prompts for yourself is a way to engage the teachings. So there are two things that I think are, well, it's really one thing that helped me make writing prompts is when I'm looking at it, if there's a chunk of it that doesn't organize well in my mind, I might pull it out and say, what's going on there? If there's a chunk of it that raises a question, I might pull it out and say, what's going on there? And definitely, to me, this is a lot like dream analysis, where you pull out something. If something that you're reading makes your head tilt and you go, pull it out. That's it. It's the odd detail you want to capture as you're reading. And pull it out and make an exercise of it. So I'm having a hard time deciding what to do next. I have two ideas. Okay, I'm going to go with Susan's thing. Okay, I'm going to tell you a prompt that I made out of this, and we're going to go with it, which is that instruction. Now, those four instructions at the end, let me just circle back. Joseph Goldstein wrote a very beautiful article. It was reprinted in Lion's Roar last September, called The Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And what he emphasizes is that those four instructions about do it, you know, in external, internal, arising and dissolving, just enough, and without reactivity. He says those instructions are repeated throughout the sutra, and they are, you know, it says, look at this object, but do it these four ways. Look at this object, do it these four ways. Look at that object, do it these four ways. And early sutras are often like that, very repetitive and didactic. But he keeps saying, the Buddha keeps saying, do it these four ways. So those four ways are really important. And the first one, like the internal external, is the idea of perspective. You're already getting further if you're shifting perspective on something. You can do that. And then the second one is the reminder of impermanence. Everything that we observe is not a thing. It's an activity coming and going. So remembering that is so important. Somebody was emphasizing that beautifully in their writing earlier. The third one about just enough. That's very important. If we're just gliding over life like, you know, water skiers, we're missing everything. But if you dive too deep for the call of the moment, you miss the moment too. So that kind of adjustment, that capacity to adjust, is very, very important. And then the fourth one is critical, dropping evaluation, dropping all that kind of urgent determination and just opening to the next arising. So these are all really important, and Joseph Goldstein explains it really well. So I wanted to work with that third one, just enough, not too much. And we're going to do a short thing, which involves my phone timer again. How about if we just take a couple of really deep breaths and pay attention to where you notice the breathing? Okay, have your pen ready. We're going to write. But just without anything but dwelling where you can feel it. Okay. You're going to describe what makes you know that you are breathing there. And you now have 20 seconds to describe it. Go. Okay. Now take two more deep breaths right back there. Now describe what makes you know there's breath there. You have 2 minutes. Go. A lot of good feelings for the interactions of mindfulness and writing. And I'm just going to say a few things that are specific about ways I see these two practices interacting, and then we'll move on to some other things. First of all, right, this was mentioned, a lot of these things came up in our discussions, but writing slows down the pace of thought. And that's a very important aspect of why writing helps us in a different way than speaking and interacting. This is a calming factor, and it does give us a kind of distinct increased feel for the flow of process. So this broader view increases intuition and memory, and there's more room to understand movement when we slow down. Related, and I can't stress the importance of this enough, is that writing forces us to completion in a lot of our thoughts that we do not finish otherwise. When we're just thinking to ourselves or speaking, we leave off so much. When we have all the steps of perception that we study in the Abhidharma, they talk about how frequently we don't go through all the steps, how we stop in the middle and jump to the next thing. Here's a quote from a very good old-fashioned Theravadan writer, Nyona Panika Thera, about this. Full awareness will extend up to the end phase, to the last vibrations and reverberations. Too often that end phase is cut off by an impatient grasping at new impressions or by hurrying on to the next stage of the line of thought before the earlier one has been clearly comprehended. This is one of the main reasons for the disorderly state of the average mind, which is burdened by a vast amount of indistinct or fragmentary perceptions, stunted emotions, and undigested ideas. I love that. I feel it. Slowing down will prove an effective device for recovering the fullness and clarity of consciousness. I think that's a description prior to probably people using initials like ADHD, but it really captures a lot of how we all are. So if it's on the level of a sentence or on the level of a page or on the level of a journal entry, the more that's written, the more there is this sense that we get in the habit of completing the thought, registering the impression. And Carol has a thought there. Oh, you need to unmute.
Yeah. Actually, it's that quote is just so powerful for me. Is there any way that when we email you that you could, like, there's so many jewels that you're offering, and I'm like, how am I gonna, you know, get them back? And I wonder if that would be too much to ask of you.
Not at all. So you'd like the where do the references come from?
Well, or the references themselves. I mean, themselves. Like this quote here. The quote. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
That is not difficult to do at all. I can put all that together. And it is, it's a gem of a quote. Nyona Panika Thera is like he a great writer, a great describer of human processing. Even though he's very old timey and Theravadan, he just nails it a lot. So I'm happy to send you that. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's such a good point. And so this kind of gets back to that idea of the Zen idea, studying the self to forget the self. But until we really observe carefully, it's hard to know what we're letting go of. Mm-hmm. So this aspect of writing, I have come to feel is, you know, more than critical. Another thing that we've really touched on in the morning is that writing takes various modes of experience and kind of puts them all through this mill of language. And so the language is this common, deep human structure, but we've heard so much bodily experience, sensory experience, emotional experience, and it's like digestion. Writing kind of breaks it all down into the little pieces that we can use. This also has a function of kind of leveling off our preferential modes of experience. So very frequently, I think of this in terms of the skandhas, the five skandhas that we mentioned before. Very frequent, I guess all of us probably have a skandha that we tend to exist in mostly. It's our kind of preferential mode. And part of what happens with writing and crunching through everything is that we level this off. We can very purposely move into other modes of functioning and experiencing and just stay there with it in the writing. And that's one of the most valuable things I think you can do. And that's why I say to shake up your normal way of writing every now and then. Because what you do kind of crunch through in language and in making this visual thing in front of you is now territory that you're familiar with and territory that is part of your repertoire. So that's another thing. The actual movement of the mental material through the body and onto the page or screen is an energetic shift every single time we write. There's something that happens. And I think most of us have felt that many times. You know, it just moves it out. Turning your thoughts into a literal object reminds you that your thoughts always were just literal objects, but they were literal objects that felt like they were inside the skull. And now they are literal objects that feel like they're on this. It's another kind of leveling out aspect of writing that's so important. And it kind of neutralizes the content because you get below your judgmental or habitual view because you have this physical step of remove. It's like that thing they say, you know, always count to 10 before you press send on an email or text. You know, it just gives you that automatic little bit of breathing room between the internal process and what happens with it. So that way you don't really feel like you're in your process or your process is in you. And those are two personality errors that, are discussed as part of the Abhidharma and original Buddhism. And you kind of avoid those personality errors somewhat when you write about your process. So I think what I'm talking about here is true of any creative process. If you are in visual consciousness in your painting, if you are in auditory consciousness in your composing music, I think some of this holds true. But language also adds this kind of medium of human connection. Language is our main way, and maybe this is just how our culture has evolved, but it is our main way of sharing our process and realizing that everybody's process is going on just like ours. And so that is another just important part of the writing moment, that we are creating something that is shareable if we choose to. And even if we don't choose to, we've still gotten it out there where it can be. I was just listening, had the good fortune of listening to a fairly extensive bird song this morning. And, that's language for sure. I don't know how much meaning translation, bringing it up the way we bubble it up into such specifics, but it had, you know, just the same amount of variation and patterning and weaving of atmosphere. There are many ways to do this, but language is the way we're all pretty used to it. And language is something deep, deep in us. And so the more you write, I guess the more you and language, us and language become acquainted. And the more just interpenetration there is between the state of mind and the potential of language. So when we get this deeper, this broader vantage point, we get this very panoramic and yet poignantly specific view. And this is our human life and this is language. So let's go on to a different kind of exercise. And instead of thinking about the aspect of mindfulness where we try to stay with an object, let's think about the more Zen emphasis of a choiceless object and just seeing what arises. I think of every journal entry as a big scale, choiceless object that you go to it and you don't decide, I'm going to cover this and this and this today. You just go to it and see what arises. So in this exercise, we're going to do literal bare notation. So what this means is we're going to just do a little sitting. And if you can do this, get your writing implement right by you so that you can sit comfortably and write. So I'm like just right here at a desk, and I kind of do this like I just have my left hand resting on my thigh and my right hand is resting on the desk with the pen. And what we're going to do is just spend a few minutes in some kind of a meditative state. And every time something arises to that point of language that we felt before, jot it down. Try not to jot down more than two or three words, and it's line by line. So when you jot down something, the next thing you're going to jot down will be on the next line or below it. And, you know, try to jot things down when they get to the point of language and words. And then after you jot it down, try to drop it. So it's just weaving in a little writing into your bare notation of meditation. And, you know, it might be any category of arising. Any of your sense consciousnesses may arise. So if it's a visual sense consciousness, then you have to do a little translation to say, you know, don't say image of flower, that's getting too involved, but just maybe yellow flower. If it's a body sensation, just jot down achy back. If some person arises, just jot down their name. That kind of thing. So just try to be like one, two words and drop it and then just go on and try to settle back. So does that feel clear enough what we're attempting to do here? Okay, let's everybody, I'm going to go on mute. Let's just spend maybe 5-6 minutes on this, and then I will ring a gong to end. I'll try to. I promised that I wasn't going to do much Abhidharma, but I forgot I had a whole big Abhidharma chart for you. So I'm going to bring this in. We're now moving into teachings about emptiness. And the point here is that emptiness is not a thing. And emptiness is all this interactivity around us, in us, through us. And these teachings, I think, enrich our capacity to draw our writings from very, very deep sources beyond us. I know that you've probably all had the experience of writing something and you go, where did that come from? Which was our initial question, I just remembered. But there are times we just simply can't answer it. And so I think that these teachings just give us, again, different angles to look at this word emptiness. And so this is all just by way of saying I'm going to share screen and try to bring up this chart. Now, sorry, this might take me a minute because I think I accidentally closed things before, so I'm sorry. This is going to take me a minute. Okay. Are you getting it now? Do you see a chart?
Yes.
View. Okay. Let me move you guys so I can see it a little bit too.
Can you make it larger?
Yeah. Okay. Is it still pretty much on the screen? I see a lot of glasses wiggling and stuff. You guys okay? Okay. Okay. The Abhidharma in a nutshell. I know many of you probably know a great deal about it, so I'm just going to take it from the top for those who might not. The Buddhist canon was in the Tripitaka, three baskets. The Vinaya was the basket that contained all the monastic codes and rules and for those who were living monastic lives. The sutras are the discourses of the Buddha in verbal talk. And they are, a lot of the old sutras, I'm just going to say they're, for a lot of reasons, a lot of people believe pretty close to the original teaching voice of the Buddha. So if you kind of want to get the teaching voice of the Buddha, you read the sutras. The Abhidharma is a body of texts that are lists and matrices, and they are the original vision of the Buddha. So the teaching voice is kind of the sutras, but the Abhidharma is the vision, the architectural blueprint of in the universe and all the realms of existence and all the ways they interact. The Abhidharma is outrageous, just outrageous. The Abhidharma exists on no scale. The Abhidharma describes 17 steps of perception that happen in a third of a second. The Abhidharma describes beings that live for 84,000 eons. It's just all over the place. There's no scale. But what it really describes, it breaks everything down in a very analytic, systematic way. And then it synthesizes everything by telling how all these pieces work together. So this table is probably Abhidharma 101, if you had to have it. And it's just to refresh your right hemisphere now, okay? We're out of language. We are in structure, pure, pure structure. Now, these blocks all have words in them, tell you what they are, but we're in pure structure. And I'm just going to tell you really quickly what this chart tells us, and then we're going to use it for writing. Okay, so first I'm going to read you another one of these really great quotes. This is by Red Pine. No, first I'm going to explain it, then I'll tell you the Red Pine quote. Okay, this breaks up. It starts with the first line is ultimate realities. Okay, so we're not starting with anything minor here. These are the ultimate realities in Buddhism: matter, mental factors, nibbana, or that's Pali for nirvana, and consciousness, which is citta. So basically, this isn't in visual order, but basically we have consciousness, its components, the material phenomena of the world, and the unconditioned beyond it aspect. That's all there is in reality. But we're going to move down to the next three rows now, which are descriptions of conditioned reality. What you can see is that little strip of Nibbana is gone. Okay, so the five aggregates, the 12 sense spaces, and the 18 elements are three ways of describing all of conditioned reality. All the reality that we exist in, make up, interact with, are in these lists. Now, they are the same thing. The five aggregates, the 12 sense spaces, and the 18 elements, they're the same thing. They're just broken up differently. Are y'all doing okay so far? Okay, I love this stuff, but I know not everybody does. But okay, so the five aggregates are the skandhas that I'm sure most of you have studied: form, feelings, perceptions, habit formations, and consciousness. You might have heard different terms, but those are the five bundles of experience that we use to construct ourself and our understanding of this world that the self is moving in. Now, another way of looking at that is you can break it down into six bases and six objects. Now, the six bases are the five senses we usually think of, plus mind as a sense. Those are the six bases. And then the six objects are the things that those bases meet. So another way you could divide up all of conditioned reality is saying there's nothing to conditioned reality except for sight, smell, sight, hearing, smell, taste, body sensations, mind, and things we see, things we hear, things we smell, things we taste, things that happen to our bodies, and things we think. That's just another way of slicing it up. Doing okay? The 18 just adds a different element, which is to say all of those meetings, like the meeting of the eye base and the visual object, happen in a field. And that field we could call visual consciousness. So the 18 is pretty much just saying the thing that sees, the thing it sees, and the consciousness field. The thing that hears, the sound it hears, and the auditory field, etc. So that's how I divide it into 18. This may seem like, well, big deal, but it is very basic structure of how to enter reality, and it is very basic Buddhism. And this is where I'm going to bring in Red Pine. Red Pine, you know, is an amazing translator and commentator and writer in his own right. In the centuries following the Buddha's nirvana, instruction centered around a trio of concepts designed to focus attention in such a way that the non-existence of the self would become evident and the liberation from suffering would follow. These included the five aggregates, the 12 sense bases, and the 18 elements. These were three views of the same thing, our mind. They were simply different ways of dividing any given moment of awareness into a manageable matrix to demonstrate to anyone willing to wander around in these matrices that they contain the universe of our awareness, its inside and its outside, and yet in no self. That was their function, to show practitioners that there was no self. So this structure tells us everything that we know that happens can happen without saying, I did it, it's mine, I'm in it. You don't need any pronoun. You can just describe everything that's happening with these elements. I'm going to take down this and talk a little bit about the idea of a base. And then we're going to write. The sense bases, there were the six sense bases. And, you know, you might think that the base, the visual base is like your eye. But the visual base is not your eye. The visual base is the tiny, tiny bit of matter that interacts with some wave of chemicals or lights or motion that allows a translation of that wave to go into your brain and start thought. That's a visual base. So I'm going to give you some examples of how they meant it. Now, back in the early day,
someone Ginger, has
yeah, thank you, Ginger. I see. Ginger, what was your question there? Thank you for slowing me down if you need to.
Who was I going to ask? What's the difference of no self and emptiness?
Um, Not really any. I would say no self is a way of expressing emptiness. I think of emptiness as maybe a little bit broader, saying emptiness is just that everything is in motion and meeting, but there's no self in that.
Yeah, but does that mean non-clinging?
That leads to non-clinging, yes. Because there's nothing to cling to, and there's nothing to do the clinging.
So they're both, but how are they different, the two of them?
Well, how is it?
Non-self and emptiness.
Okay, that's really hard. This is sort of just how I see it, Ginger, and it's really a tough one, what you're asking. But my sense is that emptiness is a broader way of saying it. And non-self is a component. But either focus, I think, leads you to the same thing. So that's the best I can do with your good question. But Jody either has a thought on this or another question, so she may be helpful here.
Yeah, I'm not helpful for that question, I'm afraid. But I have never heard of base before, so I wanted you to repeat what that is, because I couldn't keep up with it.
Okay. The base is the physical material necessity for the process to occur. It's like the necessary condition for the process to occur. But it's not a gross thing like the whole eyeball. It is like, let me take the ear, like the way the ear works, like there's these little tiny cilia and they're in a water base and they translate a sound wave into that water base, which amplifies it. And then that fires a neuron. So the base, the necessary physical equipment for hearing to occur, is essentially that cilia embedded in that liquid base.
Okay.
It's
how kind is that of, different from the ear?
It's trying to extract it to its minimum necessary requirement. Like
the cilia in the, like without like the eardrum and the other little bones, that wave of the auditory, whatever that you call that, the auditory wave or the sound wave would not get to the cilia. So they're all necessary. So I'm having trouble with this.
Yeah. And rightfully so, Jody. It's a hard thing. This is an analytic description. So you're absolutely right. I mean, the whole human body is necessary. And yeah, the ear is, that's why we say this is the organ of hearing. What they're trying to describe in the base is essentially the same thing as we were trying to describe in the point of the pen.
Okay.
It is that point of contact.
Okay.
Now, the point of contact is embedded in many systems. So you're right, and it's really hard to kind of get that. But that's what they're trying to get at when they describe the sense spaces.
Okay. I get that. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, well, I think so too. And it's one of those things, the more I try to describe it, it slips out from under me a lot, believe me. It's very, very hard. Jim, do you have something to add that will help?
Maybe. I was thinking a way to say it is that when we say ear, it's kind of a summary. it's a summary of all, you know, the ear organ and all that it can do. But it's a, when we say it, it's kind of like a summary, and really you can't, because you can't really pin it down, you know, to the cilia or to the nerve or, you know, the flap on the outside of the head.
No, I think that does help. It's a huge, complex system. And when they use the word base, they're trying to get that system, you know, down to the most minuscule interactive piece of contact. This is why Abhidharma talk is really difficult, is because it does work on so many scales, because there are so many systems that work, interact on so many scales. But that, like when I described citta as the smallest occurrence of consciousness touching on an object, it's the same idea. We're looking for a point of contact. I mean, if you just, when you sit, I think, do most of you do the mudra with thumbs touching? I often think of it in those terms too. Where your thumbs touch, there's a point that you can't feel left or right thumb anymore. There's a little puddle that's just thummy touch, right? Does that make sense? I am getting a little bit of a look like I'm not making sense. I feel like my left thumb, I feel my right thumb. But when I touch, there's a little sensation that I could not say to you is my left thumb or my right thumb. It's a point of contact. And I think that's what's trying to be described. And that's another way that I might describe it. And that is really what we were getting at in the very first thing this morning about where does the writing come from? Looking at this point of contact, everything expands from there. Just like looking at that little minute cilia, everything expands into the ear and then into the body and then into the world. I think it's very hard to throw just a bit of Abhidharma out. I'm sorry. But the main point I do want to make is about the point of contact and that it operates on so many scales. So these are the sensory scales where it operates. But the other way it operates is that our whole existence, our whole experience is our body is a point of contact. Our body is a point of contact kind of between our life and the world. Our writing expresses that, that we are where in this body, in this mind is where everything that's happened to me and all the things that led to what happened to me interact and become part of the consciousness that I'm trying to develop. I'm going to say this another way, because it is really confusing. In an Abhidharma retreat once, Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's a very big teacher and translator of Abhidharma, had a Q&A and somebody was kind of stumped the teacher and saying, well, isn't rebirth dogma? You know, if you don't believe in rebirth, this whole thing falls apart. Don't you have to believe in rebirth? And Bhikkhu Bodhi said, I don't know about rebirth, but you can develop consciousness a lot in a lifetime. And I love that answer. And so I'm talking about all these big systems kind of boiling down to something that we work with right here, us all sitting together and our pens. And I think we should write, and I should stop trying to talk about this. And let me try to set this up from all this material a little bit. The idea is that there's a point of contact between the physical world and processes. There's the pen point, there's that cilia in the ear, there's our lives, there's a point of contact. And if you consider yourself a base, like I'm talking about a sense base, you are a base. You are a necessary physical condition for a bunch of experience to turn into writing and wisdom and insight and poetry and things that move other people and help other people. You are that base. So we're going to do a writing now. from that base, from you as a base. If you think of kind of what Jindra is asking about, like emptiness as the source of your writing and your body as the base, what is the message? That's kind of vague, but I'm giving you a bit of a difficult setup there that I'd like you all to work with. Let me just say the setup once more and then tell me what questions you have that will help. The setup is thinking of yourself as a base, existing in a universe of processes that come through you, and you are going to turn these processes in your physical base into a message. And what is the message you're carrying, or the message that needs to be conveyed right now?